Some of you asked for it, so here it is. 3 hours after the voting closed, the drunken commentary track for Magnolia. I'm not drunk yet. I have not had a sip of alcohol, but I have a beer in front of me. Pamela, who's joining us, is with child and will not be partaking of alcohol. Ginger, who is a dog, will also not be drinking. If you are on the menu screen, you should push play on the count of three. One, two, three. Magnolia has been an intermittent obsession of mine for about 7 years. I think I avoided it like the plague when it first came out in theaters. And I hadn't even seen Boogie Nights at that point, which is what I think the concept of Boogie Nights, a movie which I don't like actually, having seen it, scared me off of Magnolia. When I saw it sometime on DVD in 2000, it instantly became probably my favorite movie. Since then, I have written extensively about it. I have an aborted book. I have an aborted wiki project. And now we have this one.
They're not aborted yet.
They're, how about stillborn or...
In limbo is my preference.
Cryogenically preserved.
That's fine.
I've taught a class on it, an 8-hour class as part of a community education project. And these three prologue stories, which has been pointed out since, have been, or at least some of them are, have some elements of urban legend. The relationship to the rest of the narrative is not really clear, even after the movie's over. Do you feel like they're necessary? That they add anything? I guess it's fairly obvious that they're not necessary. Or do they add something to the movie?
Ask me in 3 hours.
It seems to me that the purpose of these stories, the primary purpose, deals with the suspension of disbelief. How Ricky Jay, the narrator, closes this section basically says these strange things happen all the time. And so when there are strange things that happen in Magnolia, lots of coincidences, and then eventually, not to spoil the surprise for anybody, but the rain of frogs, you've been prepped for it.
But is that a coincidence?
The rain of frogs?
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a bit. It's not a coincidence, but it's a strange thing, though.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it's.
But I don't know that you can add those all together, and these things all add up. These coincidences, however you want to consider them, make for an unusual whole. The rain of frogs is just an unusual whole. There's nothing coincidental about its existence.
What do you think these three things do together? You'll notice, like, here the kid is about to jump off the building. There's an 8 and a 2 in rope over to the left of him. There are lots of 8s and 2s throughout.
Is it rope? I guess it is rope.
There are lots of 8s and 2s throughout the movie. If you are a casual moviegoer who doesn't pay a whole lot of attention to the obsessive fans on the web, you might not notice those 8s and 2s, but they're all over the place. And they represent Exodus... chapter 8, verse 2, in which the plague of frogs is unleashed on Pharaoh. What do these three stories do as a whole? Is there a progression? Do they play off each other in any way that's of interest or that relates to the movie?
Sorry, I just thought the shut the fuck up at that moment was just perfect.
Sorry, we got a long road ahead of us, lady. You don't have an answer, or you?
I don't know, because I mean, you have the three men who have the last names of the town, and then you have the diver dropped into the tree of the forest fire. And did I miss one before
no.
this?
No, there's a cop and a kid there, which I think is sort of is a bit of foreshadowing in a way.
True.
I think what in the three stories there's almost a progression of tragedy. All three involve tragic things that happen. But the coincidence, the level of coincidence in the third story, in all the different ways that the tragedy could have been prevented, it's sort of contrasted with the first two stories, which are just kind of one of those which are basically just ironic stories, just like rain on your wedding day. And this one, which takes up a bulk of the time here, there's a lot more going on, and there are, you know, a dozen, you know, half a dozen, dozen points where had something been a little different, whether it's an intervention of somebody helping somebody out, or, you know, just somebody being a little to the left or a little to the right.
Or a little nicer to each other.
Right. It could have been prevented. This didn't have to happen. In the first two stories, that's not true.
No, I think it's absolutely true. This didn't have to happen. You didn't have to commit a murder. The vagrants didn't have to commit a murder. The middle one is the one that I might argue isn't like that.
Well, you're right. Of course, the murder didn't have to happen.
It's just dumb bad luck that the diver's in the lake where they're...
So maybe there's a spectrum of... Some coincidences are just funny or strange, and some are, I think, tragic.
Mm-hmm.
You get the real quick introduction of all the major characters. There's Frank Mackey. Nice hair, Tom.
Ugh. I know you aren't actually admiring it, but...
Have you ever called 1-877-TAME-HER?
No. You?
Could you tell me what part of the anatomy the dock is?
What is it? What did it say?
Wet your dock. Any hard-bodied blonde, I think? Second major character, Claudia. He's genuinely creepy, isn't he?
Yes.
Of course, she's being watched by her father there, in a sense.
Her father, also creepy.
Yes. Jimmy Gator.
We don't know that he's her father, though, at that point.
Correct.
Till now, to that moment, I assume.
I don't even think it goes by so fast. You have to be paying a lot of attention. There's Jimmy's wife, Rose, Stanley Spector. Stanley Spector feeding the dogs.
I don't even remember that from before.
Stanley's dad.
Do you consider him major?
No, I consider him a minor character.
Okay.
I think there are 9 major characters, if I remember correctly. Do you get a sense of the characters? Do you feel like you have a sense of the characters from these introductions?
No. Certainly not. I think the only one you get any sense of is Rose, or not Rose, but Claudia. And I think that's a function of having an opinion about women who hang out in bars and troll for creepy anonymous sex involving cocaine. So rather than a sense of her. You get a sense of...
You get a sense of Frank, though. I mean, clearly. I mean, you cannot like what you see.
That's true.
You get a sense of Donnie.
Hapless Donnie.
Hapless. Getting braces as a middle-aged adult.
That's not nearly as hapless to me as plowing over the parking block and into the plate glass of a store.
Phil Palmer, followed by... I can't remember her name. Julianne. Moore. I think this is, to me...
Linda,
yes. It's not exactly a short segment, but I think you really... It's a very concise introduction to the characters. I think they're... You are able to form initial impressions of them very quickly. And you might not understand them. And here's
and maybe that's what I'm saying. Is you're right, I get the idea of them, but they don't mean anything to me yet.
Now, here the movie, we've been, all these interactions have been very brief, and now here we get to spend quite a bit of time with Jim Curry. And whereas, as I wrote very recently, you have all this activity going on, here he's eating breakfast, having a cup of coffee, watching TV, working out, taking a shower.
Listening to his own personal ad.
I don't think that's actually...
Okay. Good.
I don't think that's sourced sound. And praying. And so there's this, all this stuff going on, and then he's just sort of quietly having his morning routine. That mustache is, whoever decided that he had to have that mustache. It's a perfect detail.
Genius.
And the hair, there's nothing he can do about that, but the mustache completes the picture. And they look at all these people going out as with partners, and he's alone. And if that weren't clear enough, you get him in the car, talking to himself.
Is there anybody without a partner in that scene?
I don't know. I mean, when they were walking out all together, they were clearly paired up, and he is not. And of course, this is shot in essentially as a joke. This is the setup to the punchline. The punchline comes when you get a shot through the windshield and you see that there's nobody else in the car with him. You also get a sense of his, the way this is shot, you also get his acne scars, which is, I think, gives a sense of, I'm not sure what it means, but I think it's... I noticed it when I was looking at it for getting screen captures for what I wrote recently. Well, there ends the introductions after about 13 minutes of essentially prefatory material. Is it prefatory or professory?
My favorite character.
you get... If you've never heard of this movie, after the scene with Marcy, what do you think it is? And this is pure comedy, and there's really no... I mean, there's what's happening here sets up plot that happens in the rest of the movie, but...
I never noticed the gumball and candy machines back there before. Sorry.
But there's no... The plot isn't essential. It's essentially it's a MacGuffin. The mystery that's set up here, or the police problem that is established here, is never resolved. It's resolved a little more in the screenplay, but I think Paul Thomas Anderson ditched it. I don't know if he didn't film it or what, but it's not in the movie. But the scene with Marcy is very comic. Even you know, when there's a dead person found in the closet. Again, sorry to spoil it for you if you haven't seen it before. obviously, that's a serious matter, but it's done in such a funny way. Question we raised in the class, that is Marcy's, after all the white people we've seen, Marcy's black. There's another black woman in the movie, upper class or well-to-do professional who essentially emasculates Tom Cruise's character. And you've got Dixon, who's a little black boy. A question we raised and never really answered was, is Magnolia racist? And this is not, and this is welfare mother stereotype, essentially. You're not going to make me talk by myself for 3 hours, are you?
No, I just...
You're watching, aren't you? You're not supposed to watch, you're supposed to talk.
I'm sorry. Why welfare mother? I mean, I know kind of what you're saying, but...
She's in her... It's 10:30 in the morning. She's got sheets over her windows. It's not a very well-kept apartment. She's belligerent. She's loud.
She doesn't like the cops.
She drags the couch. Do not drag that couch any further. Do you feel like that character is sharply enough drawn to avoid... Let's just narrow the question a little. Is the character of Marcy sharply enough drawn that... It's not a stereotype. Whoa, what the hell is this, Marcy? That ain't mine.
That line gets used a lot around here. do I think that she's not a stereotype?
Is the character sharply drawn enough that she transcends stereotype?
Having spent a fair amount of time in traffic court where those women come into court in sweatpants and house slippers, fuzzy house slippers, so often that we started calling them defendant slippers. the ones that you buy at Kmart or Walmart, and you know, they come in very bright colors. Red was very popular with defendants. She's very familiar to me.
Do you feel like she's a real character? I mean, she's not that's the only time she's
absolutely.
In the movie. So, I mean, she didn't have a whole lot of time to make an impression.
And I actually wasn't kidding about her being my favorite. She's...
Speaking of being emasculated, I was accosted in my class by a woman who was a psychologist,
yes.
I believe. Who, when I called Linda Partridge hysterical, I think I was speaking of women generally in the movie, but specifically about Linda Partridge, I called her hysterical. I was given a semantics lesson on the origins of hysterical, which has to do with female, I don't know specifically genitals, but with hysteria's semantic source is as a female problem. And there was... criticized for use of the word, and probably fairly in a way, in the sense that I was using it ignorantly. But once you know the definition, I think there's a strong case to be made that the women in Magnolia, and the key women, who are Lindy and Claudia primarily, have a different way about them in the world than the men do. Their emotions are right there on the surface, and they are broken and in pain and lost. The men are equally lost.
Where does Rose fit in?
She's a secondary character.
Okay.
But she's an important one. I mean, I think if we were to tier characters, I guess... Rose and Phil are probably similar. feels a little more... I mean, Rose... Part of the problem with Rose as a character is that she's in the background. That's part of her character. She is the supportive wife. She only steps forward.
She's also the mother who failed to protect.
Yes.
And that's important.
Right, but she's in the background. And it is only when... it is only when Jimmy admits to her what she already knows that she switches sides from when she goes from being the dutiful wife to being an actual mother. And so she essentially steps forward.
Very late in the game.
Very late in the game. But it's in the same way that I think Jim Curring does. I mean, Jim Curring has been established as somebody who believes himself to be pious and a good man and a true to God, but there's nothing you see in him that's lives up to the Christian ideal until the end of the movie. So I think both he and Rose sort of step up. The problem with Phil as a character is that he's essentially he doesn't progress any. He's decent and loving and kind, and he's obviously paid to be that way as a hospice nurse. But
I don't think anybody.
No, but you can't do that. You can't do that if you aren't.
Yes.
But Phil is that way at the beginning. I mean, this conversation with.
Can I help you?
Damn it, Jason Robards. I knew that. I couldn't think of a character name. I still can't, but. And this conversation with Jason Robards' character, I think, really establishes him. And I don't think anybody plays empathy the way that Philip Seymour Hoffman does here. I mean, it's just, you can see it in the eyes and the face, just the way he's genuinely listening to somebody who's making no sense. It's a wonderful little performance. I don't think it's a great performance. It matches the role very well. Jason Robards is dead, right?
Yes. I think this is his last role. Because we had that conversation when he died.
Well, shit, he can't even get a line out without hacking up a lung. He's on oxygen. He never gets up. He's in bad shape.
It's the movies.
Oh.
And it was funny, I think, when he died, it didn't feel surprising having seen him this way.
I don't know what his... I mean, obviously, he was lucid and strong enough to be able to sit in a bed for take after take after take. I'm guessing he was in very good health at the point that he filmed this, but I could be wrong, but it's interesting how roles bleed into perception and how... It's an interesting comment, I just think, because it clarifies how we have difficulty separating people from their roles.
Yes.
Of course, this little conversation sets into motion, I guess, what's arguably the plot of the movie, to the degree that there is plot other than stuff happening. What is he doing? You've been in the theater. What is he doing with his eyes and his mouth and his face that is so effective there? It's effective to me anyway. You might disagree. You might think it's terrible acting. And he's barely moving.
I think the trick is... I don't mean trick. But the key is... I went to high school with somebody who... had the extraordinary ability...
Notice the dog.
Hi, dog.
The dog will be dead.
There are three dogs.
Oh, that's right.
Four dogs.
Yeah. Some of them will die.
Just some?
Yeah. I think they only take a couple out of the stretchers. It's a lovely little transition there. The oral transition with the music and the epiphany that he's having. And moving that with the introduction of Frank Mackey in the flesh.
To go back to answer the question real quickly, as a high schooler, somebody...
This is a long section, so we'll have plenty of time to talk.
I know, but you'll move on, and it won't get resolved, and then someone will be unhappy. But I went to high school with this guy.
I listened to 3 fucking hours, and he didn't even finish the story about high school?
My point exactly. Went to high school with this guy. But you hadn't heard that part yet. And he had this extraordinary ability. I'm not sure I recognized it at the time as being extraordinary, but when he talked to you, there wasn't any question that he was entirely focused on you. And I can't remember who said something about listening is the silence while you wait to talk or something like that. And it was never like that with him.
Sounds like your dad.
Yes, it does sound like my dad. It was never like that with him, though. You always really genuinely believed that he was hearing you. Whether that was true or not, I still don't know to this day. But I think that's what I see in that performance, is the ability to genuinely focus in a way that most people don't.
As an actor? Or as a character?
He has an understanding of that ability that most people don't have. I think our friend Becky told my dad once about another friend, who was always... There was always a pause after you finished speaking when you were talking to him. And she always thought it was unnerving because he wasn't just waiting to talk. He was genuinely listening to you.
And we don't want that.
Becky, I don't know that she does. I'm teasing. It's just, it's interesting to me that's something that's affecting, and that I can pick out 2 instances in my life that I see there, and that it's not common.
I'm pausing.
Oh, you're pausing, I see, to reflect on what I've just said, which is... No, kidding.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Here's the second black woman, who was alluded to earlier. Do you buy...
Captain Muffy? Is that really his name?
Where did Captain Muffy come from?
He says, I'm Captain Muffy, I'm his personal assistant.
Do you buy the seduce and destroy section?
Yeah.
Why?
I wish I didn't.
We were talking about stereotypes and exaggeration. And the whole movie is kind of pitched at this level of... I think when I first read about it, and I don't know if I'd stand by this part, but I call it hyper-reality, where everything is sort of condensed and pitched too high, a little too much.
Concentrated.
Yeah. And this is, you could almost put this on Saturday Night Live, and I'm just using that because that's kind of the standard, even though nothing on Saturday Night Live is funny. And it would play as satire, I think. Satire of the men's movement, satire of self-help group, satire of men. But good satire only works, and good satire is distinct from Saturday Night Live. Good satire only works if there's a reality to it. Do you see a reality there?
Unfortunately, yes. I think I agree with you that it's just too, a little too intense a truth to be real. That's not quite accurate, but it does seem pitched higher than the reality would be, but it certainly has an underlying element of truth that it rings true to me in a way that is very sad.
This is something I never noticed before when I think it's Guinevere sits down in the audience, and I think it's one of Frank's assistants asks her if she has everything she needs. He puts his arm around her and touches her shoulder, which of course is I'm guessing, one of the techniques for making a woman think you care about her. It's a nice little touch. What do you think of Tom Cruise's performance? And so much as he has fallen so far in public esteem, and he's become a punchline.
This is the only role I've ever thought he was fantastic in.
Why is he fantastic in it? How is this different from other performances?
I guess because you're talking about separating actors from their roles. This role gives me the feeling that I'm seeing who he really is. It's probably not true. He's probably not fundamentally evil. But I mean, Top Gun, Rain Man, all these big toothy grin, I'm a nice guy, really. All that bullshit I don't buy. This, I believe, he has in him. And I think that's why I read it a great performance.
Did you read it that way when you first saw it? Because I see it in the eyes. I see a kind of a real hardness in his eyes that I hadn't noticed before. And what I think about is the intensity of his jumping on Oprah's couch, or when he was on, I think it was on the Today Show, and he and Matt Lauer had a little spat.
Perfect word.
I see, in retrospect, given what has happened in the intervening 8 years, I could certainly see that. But did you see that when you first saw the movie?
I don't know. I think I've always thought it was his best performance of his career. Whether it was because I could articulate it as I have now, I don't know. But I've always felt like he found something in the role that spoke to him in a way that nothing else does. Nothing else he's ever done has. And it's not just about being a bad guy. I mean, actors play bad guys all the time against type, and some do it well, some don't do it very well at all. But this, feels like he found something that fit him.
Do you think he knows that?
I don't know.
I mean, he probably fancies himself a pretty good guy.
I don't doubt that.
And righteous. And he probably sees this as being something completely different from who he really is. It's a matter of complete, if we're talking about credibility, the suspension of disbelief. If a guy, if a one-night stand is staying over at your apartment,
there's a knock at the door. He's long gone by the time the sun comes up. I'm sorry.
If there's a knock at your door, he's not going to answer the fucking door.
He's going to hide under the covers.
And he's going to pretend he doesn't hear it.
I'd like to point out, though, going back to your stereotypes, that Marcy and her sheet-covered windows are not the only ones.
That's a good point. And, of course, I think the sheet curtain, sheet/curtain falls down in the Rain of Frogs as well.
Yeah, I think it does.
Philip Baker Hall has the most tremendous eye bags. This dynamic is, we've seen them both having casual sex in the introduction, and there's a bit of hypocrisy.
He wasn't having sex with Rose?
No, he was having sex with a little showgirl, like somebody from the show or something.
Okay.
You know, so he was,
I couldn't imagine Rose being down with that, but, you know.
He was shown, you know, the voiceover talked about him being a family man with, you know, he's been married for X number of years, and he was having sex with somebody else. So there's a hypocrisy there, but this conversation, who do you think? He comes off as decent and she comes off as crazy because you don't have any context for that relationship? I mean, or do you read it differently? Do you know, do you have a sense of the history here? Do you infer the sense, the history?
I don't remember how I first felt about her and whether she was a lunatic. But my read now, even trying to ignore what I know, is that you don't behave that way toward your father for not a good reason. It's unlikely.
Not at her age.
Right.
You might when you're 15.
Absolutely. Although the likelihood of my saying fuck to my father at 38 is getting better every day, but it's still not very high.
One of the truest lines in the movie is Solomon saying, "Don't get strong, Donnie."
Mm-hmm.
Solomon just said to Donnie, "Don't get strong, Donnie." Mm. And it's kind of a malapropism. But he, like Jim, is pretty feeble in a lot of ways. And he was essentially speaking truth to him. And I think Jim is set up as comic relief, but so is Donnie. I mean, Donnie is meant to be mocked. And I think even at the end, even by the end, he never crosses the line to become poignant, I think. Only in his patheticness.
I think in the bar.
That's the closest. Yes, I agree with that.
Right, that's
giving
heartbreaking
it away.
To me.
What part? He's so self-centered. It's funny. It's there's no consideration on his part. Well, I'm interested in your answer, but while you're thinking, rather than have the dead silence, he's not reacting. You know, if somebody says, "I'm going to fire you," and your argument should be, "You can't fire me because I do my job well. I'm valuable. I do my job." He says, "You can't do this. This is the worst time. I've got this going on." I mean, it's just complete. It's a little bubble. He doesn't even recognize that he has a responsibility to his employer, or that he is supposed to do a good job. And the silent Jesse Raphael glasses.
Which part about...
In the bar. What's heartbreaking?
He seems so... There's such great longing in him and no outlet, no... He can't find his way to what he needs. He has no skills.
Is he the only one who doesn't find his way?
Well, everybody's lost. We've said that.
No, but is he the only one who doesn't make progress? I mean, I think everybody else in the movie kind of moves toward where they need to be. Whereas he shows the potential that he might, but he isn't there yet. I mean, at the end, he's still the one who says, I have so much love to give and I don't have anywhere to put it, which is mm-hmm. goes exactly to what you were saying about him not having an outlet. What are you looking for?
Your next, please.
That is unrelated to the commentary.
With batteries. Thank you.
So, one thing I realized just in the past few days, he's a Los Angeles cop.
You mean like Rodney King, Los Angeles?
Yes. That he's the kind of... I think that's a good thing to point out. Rodney King, Los Angeles. He's in that police department. And yet, he is completely out of touch. He has... He's like a small town cop almost. You ever been to juvenile hall? I mean, to be a cop who's intolerant of a kid using profanity, for instance, and being seemingly shocked by it.
Right, it's very Mayberry.
Yeah, and it's Los Angeles.
Which word, though? I don't need to hear that word.
What's going through his mind right here? He's actually listening. But he's almost like he's listening only for the profanity that he knows is coming. Because he doesn't get anything from it. He doesn't even know what it means. Dixon is the little kid, shows up later and steals stuff from Linda Partridge and calls 911 for her. Real Helpful iced tea. Coolio and iced tea. I think all of them were passe by 1999, weren't they? Iced tea was on like Law and Order at that point, wasn't he?
By 99? I don't know. He might have been.
And I believe we've been pretty much without the score up until this point. We're 40 minutes in.
Well, we've had Amy Mann.
Right, over the credits.
Yeah.
Well,
the first 13 minutes.
No, it wasn't for the... No, not for the original stories.
Oh, okay.
Not for the prologue stories.
Right.
But we're essentially, the score is introduced at about the 40-minute mark. Now, obviously, I mean, you can't make a guy write stuff for 3 hours. That's too much, but it's interesting that I think you've been without music for nearly half an hour at this point. I believe there have been people who have identified certain elements of the things on there as having relationships to Exodus 8 and 2, Letters of Our Changing Weather is one of the books right there. History of...
Freemasonry.
Freemasonry is actually a motif that shows up a couple times.
Really?
Yes. That's a nice jacket. I'm being face ties. The pronunciation is also face ties. It's a lovely score, I think, and it's not overbearing.
Nope, I like it a lot.
It's a long tracking shot right here, just for the record. It starts at 43 minutes and a half. And we go from outside in the rain to interiors and... And apparently because it's part of William H. Macy's contract, Felicity Huffman has to have some role.
Well, it could just as easily be part of hers for sports time.
Yeah, they can't get work separately, can they?
I don't know, is he in the transsexual movie?
No idea. Transamerica?
Yes. I couldn't remember the name of it, oddly.
This is the epitome of the walking and talking.
The Aaron Sorkin pediconferencing?
That sounds dirty and illegal.
Happens on the West Wing all the time.
Yeah, it should be illegal.
Hey.
What's the function of the really long tracking shot here? It's a bit of a rhetorical question.
Oh, good.
It's a way of connecting the characters. I mean, a long tracking shot connects things. You know, it's kind of like the family circus thing with the dotted lines and Billy going all over the place. I just don't like the metaphor, or you don't like the analogy, or it's not very useful.
No, I get it, and it actually.
And what we're doing here is we're not following a character. We're following a bunch of character, and then it's like the camera's kind of getting bored, and so I'm kind of bored with these people. And there's the end of the tracking shot. So it's only 2 minutes long, but it's like the camera gets bored and says, "I'm done with you," and goes follow somebody else.
It's really like Ginger. Oh, there goes something. Oh, something else I'm interested in. Oh.
What do you think of her at this point? Those are the first words you hear from her.
What do I think of her?
Do you recognize her even now?
What do you mean?
The one role that most everybody knows her from? Close Encounters?
Oh.
Barry's mother?
Yes. No. Obviously not. I don't have the impression of her that I end up with. I don't have the impression of her there that I end up with.
From what you said earlier, I think that you end up with a negative impression of her, even though she comes around that she was too late.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there, so she seems to be somebody trying to keep it together with her husband and her daughter who's nuts and trying to kind of be the center of that family. And you're absolutely right that my final impression of her is that she fails everyone.
She's not redeemed by what she does at the end. Or she's not fully redeemed.
No, obviously not. Or I might change my mind in the next 2 hours and 12 minutes, but...
Yeah, I feel so over the top with everything. Fairness, it's the character. I think Phil is my favorite character. I think there's great acting right here, and I'm not sure why. I think the mouth being that open, and the way the tongue sits, and the dead eyes, and Luis! Well, that would be a non sequitur, by the way. Suspension of disbelief.
This is the precursor to Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader?
True. Might be the genesis of Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader?
Might be.
It's a lovely phone conversation here.
The best ever.
And the person's response at the end. Suspension of disbelief. A game show that's live. never happens. I mean, now, obviously, things like American Idol are live in the finales, but a game show would never be live. It's kind of this... They're just little things that are off throughout. And I think, rather than turning you off, because they're so consistent, they almost serve to sort of smooth the path. That you don't... You stop even thinking about them because everything's just not quite right. And so you just have to accept the world that's been given to you, and that eventually involves frogs. How can you eat after that?
Yeah, I love that Joss Whedon made a joke about it in the Buffy musical episode.
Which is what? What is this thing of which you speak, Buffy?
Hey. Buffy rocks.
Does he have something in his underwear? As an actor? Or as a character? Is he... In other words, is that Tom Cruise's penis? Option A. Option B, is he aroused? Is the character aroused? And then I guess the sort of two other options are, did Tom Cruise put that in his pants to give an impression about him?
Or did the character
put something in his shorts?
I'm going with the final option.
Well, clearly, I mean, the one thing you get from this is how much he's always performing. Obviously, there's essentially a stripping away of his character's performance, of the character's performance.
I thought we were rolling when he was hopping around in his skivvies
and essentially he gets broken down bit by bit throughout the movie. To reveal who he is, but it's kind of jarring. Reminds me of a line from Spinal Tap, or a segment of Spinal Tap, where they see people see us with armadillos in our trousers, and is it important that she's a black woman?
No, I don't think so. I think women are women are women. In
to him?
Yes.
Then why is she black? And there's a decision made.
I don't know that it's necessarily that.
Whether it's conscious or not, there's a decision that is made to hire somebody.
Sure.
And we could probably look it up in the script. I don't know whether her race is mentioned in the script or not, but... I contrast her with Marcy. She is the anti-Marcy, essentially. She's.
She was well-to-do, and I don't know that that's necessarily true.
That's probably true.
She's well-groomed. She's well-dressed. She's well-spoken. She's
petite compared to Marcy. She's.
She's not married.
She's not wearing a ring. It's interesting that you bring up who Tom Cruise is in the sense that his PR nightmares of the past few years have all been about trying to control interviews. And the two major things, Oprah and The Today Show, were about him trying to essentially take control. You're not going to ask me questions. I am going to dictate what goes on here. You're looking at me like I'm stupid again. Or
no.
I get the look
I'm
a lot.
I'm swashing again.
You're here in the bar with Donnie.
And the not gay bartender.
No, the gay bartender. He's
gay.
You
think gay.
He's gay?
I can't remember. Is there something that we know
about
him?
He's kind of He's the object of sexual attention, and he's dim enough that he might not realize. I think it's ambiguous, because I think he might not have any idea that essentially those two people are fighting over him.
I think I pointed out during the class that this makes it look like Johnny's at the bar with the poker machine, the video poker machine.
It's his date. Yes, you did point that out. Again, there's lots of pairing here. The people taught the way we show went from Donnie and his date to several people having conversations or being together. What is that copper bracelet? Is it one of those medical things, like improve your circulation by wearing this?
Probably.
Of course, look at this nice little in the background. You probably didn't even notice him, the Thurston Howell character in the background right there. Who is essentially his, you know, he's in there, of course, it becomes, your attention is drawn to him through focus and action, but he was lingering there for quite a while. And Donnie's competition was in his line of vision, but he didn't see him. It's interesting that he was flashing the money as well, because what Donnie doesn't have is the money.
Right.
He's being bested in an arena that he cannot compete. It's the top of his head. I mean, the hairstyle has something to do with it, and the glasses have something to do with it, but there's the impression, I hadn't thought of this, there's an impression that all the intervening time that we've just spent with other characters, she's been running around her apartment, even though it's likely between when we left and we came back, it's possible that no time has elapsed. But there's that really kind of clever filmmaking that makes it seem like for the past 10 minutes, she's been running around her apartment and he's been waiting.
Right. He always has to ask that of women, doesn't he? Nobody else here.
Well, it's interesting. There, one function of the Marshy scene is that he treats her very differently, treats Claudia very differently than he treats Marcy. Both, he was called in both places because of a disturbance, and maybe there's a report of shots fired or something.
He just dropped his baton, which is...
But, you know, she asks, is there anybody, you know, they had this long involved little conversation about, are you alone in here? And she says, I live alone, and, you know, he basically understands, that's not what I asked you, you know. He asks her that question and drops it, you know, when she didn't answer it. Which is why I think
that... And when did he have his gun drawn?
He had his gun drawn in the apartment, in Marcy's apartment, when he was looking in the closet. He did not have it drawn.
Before that?
No.
Okay.
He had his hand up to her right away. I mean, there's a distance between these two characters that there wasn't between him and Marcy. He's giving her more difference. I think... I don't want to harp too much on it, but I think there's a racial component to the movie. Getting back to Guinevere, and I might have misspoken her name earlier.
I think it's Guinevere.
I think there's a racial component to the movie because I think this scene is a clear contrast to the Marcy scene. And the main difference is the race thing. And you've got Guinevere and you've got Dixon. And I think And the way he treats Dixon is very dismissive, and he calls him Coolio and Ice Tea, and it's a very white world. The world of the entertainment industry that's essentially surrounds most everything or touches everybody in this movie. It's very white, except for Luis. Here again is officer friendly. What police department would let him out alone in Los Angeles?
Hard telling.
He's doing things like he's speaking to everybody as if they were children, like he were a DARE officer at one point and lost that job or something, lost that assignment. The "Are you alone?" question comes a little different in that context when he asks, do you have a boyfriend? So he was summoned, that's obvious, because of the argument with Jimmy.
Yes.
And the artwork, you see quite a bit of it in the background here, and when Jimmy was there too, and that obviously will play a major role. Not a major role, but it became a major point of major brief point of emphasis. And you have no doubt about the question that it responds to.
The artwork?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't. You think there's anything ambiguous about it?
I think there's a...
I don't think it's fair to not I think spell it out as long as we're talking about it, though.
I think there's a problem. I don't think either she or Jimmy is credible on the question. I mean, they both deny, and they both make an assertion. She says he molested her, or touched her, I think is the phrase, and he says he didn't. And she's fucked up enough that I have questions about her, and he's lecherous enough and duplicitous enough that I certainly don't trust him either. There's an Exodus 8:2 sign lingering back there.
And maybe it's just because...
The artwork says it, but it did happen.
Yes. And I guess it's...
Luis! I'm just going to say that every time he shows up.
Okay. I think we're probably programmed to believe that women don't make that shit up. Well, and so I start from the place that if somebody tells me that, I believe it unless I have a reason not to. And so as a result of that, all of the things that are wrong with her flow from that, rather than that flowing from what's wrong with her.
That's really interesting.
Why?
Because...
That's how I've always seen her, is that all that stuff is...
Because it becomes a circular... It becomes an unwinnable argument. You either don't believe her because there are all these things that suggest she's not trustworthy, and so that becomes untrustworthy. Or if you believe she was not, if you believe there's a possibility that she wasn't molested, that is your evidence. If you believe she was molested, that's your evidence also. It's a chicken or the egg. It's a chicken and egg question, essentially. Now this is sort of, this is strange, you know, don't be strong, Donnie. He's just sat next to his rival. That seems unlike him. This level of passive-aggressive
challenge.
Confrontation seems unlike him. I don't know who this actor is. I don't know that I've seen him before, since I'm sure I have, but it's another little lovely performance. An evil, evil man. You know who he could be?
Hmm.
He could be Teller's dad. He's got the mouth, even.
I see it.
Teller of Penn and Teller. So where does your heart break here? Is it already broken before now?
It's earlier. And that undoes it a little bit when he finds some way of expressing himself, even if it's not, it doesn't get him anywhere. That unbreaks it a little bit, but when he's just sitting there and he asks for the tequila and he seems so pathetic, that's when he's heartbreaking to me.
The line he says, "My name is Donnie Smith and I have lots of love to give," sounds like something you'd say at a meeting. Of course, you couldn't say what your last name is, but... I like that shot, the way that she's shown just eyes up. Blocked because it's nothing else is important there except her eyes. She's looking askance at them. because she knows she's being judged. If you think back about the movie, do you get a sense of its pacing and where things land in it? I would never have said that the bar scene is only only an hour into the movie. Mm-mm. I would have said it was 2 hours in. It seems to be, I guess right now the period we're in, and I think it's probably for about an hour, is pretty much real time. And it might even be overlapping time. I mean, we might be seeing things that are happening concurrently. And so that kind of goes back to that hyper-reality. There's a density of things happening right here. There's a Freemason's ring on his pinky. There's your Exodus 8:2 sign.
Yep.
We're talking about things that don't fit quite right in, not only a live game show, but the set looks like it's from 19...
Take it from them. They leave the Ghost Stanley sign, but they yank the...
The set looks like it's from the 50s. At the very...
From the 60s.
At the very latest, the 70s. Luis!
Just waiting for that.
Reminds me of Quiz Show, that shot.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's obviously it's the poster. It's, yeah. Even if it wasn't in the movie.
Sit. Philip Hager Hall. My boy.
Isn't there Ralph Fiennes?
No.
Why would you reference Quiz Show right there?
It's all about deception and whether someone's lying. Cheating.
Ah, I'm talking about the PTA. That's very clever.
What?
PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah.
So, that whole sequence right here where you're going in these, I believe it's called whip pan. Mm-hmm. There's a technical term for what's happening, these. Where you're connecting all it looks like you're basically gone. You know, you're going in the camera's going in a circle, and it's connecting. It's spatially connecting a bunch of characters who are not in the same place. It's as if it were part of the same shot. Mm. Here again, this never pays off. This is the dead body question. Of course, the fact that everybody sometime mid-afternoon would be sitting at home watching a game show. And these questions.
Chaos versus super string.
I think it's important that it's Hustler and not Playboy or Penthouse.
Well, he asked for at least Playboy.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. It was the first one he asked for.
Willa Cather. Did I get it right?
Yes, you did.
Yes! I've only seen the movie like 8 times. I didn't know that one, though.
Me either.
His dad's a real asshole.
Yes.
Of course, this is directly referenced. Suspension of disbelief is directly referenced in this phone conversation, which is a long, I think probably extends over 20 or 30 minutes, probably in the grand scheme of things, but you could ever get a telemarketer to,
Well, but he tells him, this is the part in the movie.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, and I think those opening stories, I think they really set that up well. I don't know if they fit into the larger narrative.
Earl Partridge.
Yes. What about Earl Partridge?
You couldn't come up with his name earlier.
Ah, right. Earl, that's right. Thank you for having a better memory than I do. Not hard. I don't know that they really achieve anything except for setting up all the things that are just that. I think maybe if you didn't set them up, people just go, "Oh, that would never happen." But you've been conditioned, essentially. You've been told. You were explicitly
crazy
told.
Crazy ass shit happens.
Mm-hmm. He looks like he got teeth implants, like, for bigger teeth for this role. Why would he lie? You can see the veins in his forehead.
Why would he lie?
I mean, it would be like, I mean, at some point you fabricate, and obviously we've seen people who've done things that proved that their resumes weren't quite true, but...
Or that they were just in the Minneapolis airport bathroom taking a dump.
And there's a point at which when you're on your way to becoming a public figure, I mean, you have ambitions to becoming a public figure, you have to decide whether he's making decisions about how he presents himself, but he's using things...
Cats and dogs out there, huh?
Yep.
Sorry.
He's using things... And I think the conclusion that we came to in the class, at least what was thrown out there and I found somewhat alluring as an idea, was that he's trying to get caught. That he's using things that are, there are records, his college, whether he graduated from college, whether he attended college, the name of his father and mother, whether they're alive. Those are things that are verifiable. And if you're going to lie about things, those would seem to be exactly the wrong things.
But I think I don't buy that he's looking to get caught, only because I think...
Even subconsciously?
Even subconsciously. I don't. Because I get the impression of him that he's so confident in his own...
You argued this last year.
Did I?
I think so.
I still don't buy it. I still think...
You're so predictable.
Aren't I, though? I really genuinely think that he thinks he's uncatchable, that it's not an issue. It's not...
It's a dare. It's not that he wants to get caught. No, it's not that he wants to get caught. He's daring them to catch him because he can't be caught.
He can't be caught.
And so that's how you're reading it differently from how I'm reading it.
Yes, I genuinely think he doesn't believe.
Does that look like it's been stretched vertically almost? Look how long her face is. It looks like it's the wrong aspect ratio, right? Just right there. And the way she's moving her face, her mouth. Is her face that tall and narrow?
I assume so. And the haircut certainly accentuates that.
Did you see what I saw right there? Just like almost silly putty. It was like a silly putty head.
Yes, I think he thinks he can't get caught. And so it doesn't matter what he says.
The more bald the lie, the better. I mean, it's certainly not like a little white lie, like an exaggeration that you can justify psychologically. I mean, he knows he's lying.
Yes.
Are you leaving us?
Just very briefly.
Okay.
Okay.
pregnant girls have to pee.
I understand that.
It's a long movie.
It is. You're almost halfway through.
So then I'll only have to go three more times.
So, Ginger, what do you think of this scene? This is like the scene in the movie where the guy tries to get hold of the long-lost son. But this is that scene. Pamela's missing the conversation that Phil is having about the veracity or truth, or truthiness, I guess, in the parlance of the kids, of essentially it's justifying its own existence in a way. As you can tell, I'm nothing without my wife. I have nothing to say. We're all just taking a little rest at this point. This little bit confrontation between Guinevere and Frank, he's rising to the challenge. He understands that this is not a fluff interview at this point, that he's being challenged. And it seems that his demeanor is changing a little. He's still performing, and very obviously he's looking, he's almost trying to look like he's concerned that he's being, that his credibility is being questioned. Which I think goes back to what plays into what you were saying, which is, oh, I see we're in a game now, and oh, I'm concerned, and oh, aren't you tough? Aren't these tough questions? The Phil referencing movies, and this is the scene of the movie where this happens. Let's say you took out the thing at the beginning, and you take out that, and the admonition again, the narrator's repetition of that these strange things happen all the time, which I think is repeated near the end. Does the movie play differently? Do you think those things are necessary? Are they maybe a sign of a lack of confidence on the not that I think Paul Thomas Anderson would ever be accused of a lack of confidence. I want to know when the adults got $1,025.
No doubt.
Do you think the movie needs those things?
I don't know. It's hard to imagine it without them.
It's an essential part of the movie? It would almost seem too ponderous. It's almost like it's not taking itself so seriously. On the other hand, I mean, one effect of Phil, I'm just laughing at this, the convoluted nature of what's required of the people who answer, the person who answers the question, and that's standing.
You don't have person. To. You don't have to.
I know,
say.
but the whole thing is, I was mentioning, I was talking about something. Oh, what happens when they reference movies in movies? Is that it immediately pulls you out of the movie.
We've had that one. I can't remember what it is, though.
I don't even see it. Oh, yeah, I see it. Okay. It's got a bird.
Yeah. Sorry.
Actually, I think the bird's facing the other way on that one, but anyway. When you intentionally pull somebody out of a movie, that's a sign of confidence in one way. I mean, it's a sign that
or
says...
Or stupidity.
Well, yeah.
But in this case, I agree. It's confidence.
It's saying, I
can pull you out, and you'll go right back in.
Right.
As opposed to, I didn't realize I was pulling you out, which happens plenty, too.
Right. And other times when something pulls you out of it, something pulls you out of whatever is going on and you never can find your way back in. It's the spell is broken. What do you think of Jim?
I think you're right. It's a puzzle that he's out on the streets of Los Angeles by himself.
As a small town cop, he would be great.
He'd be perfect.
He would have been killed 20 times over in L.A. at this point. Would you like to put your feet up on the table?
No.
Just want to kick your computer?
Yes.
Okay. And here he's giving a lecture about damaging your ears by playing loud music. Apparently curtains are really expensive in Los Angeles. And she, of course, is so hopeless that she can't even make a cup of coffee. It's interesting, there's a little link there. He's essentially accusing, without intentionally, he's not doing it intentionally, he has no idea, but he's accusing her dad of being her boyfriend.
Yes.
She reacts fairly strongly to. But, I mean, that there's almost, that gives credence to that she was molested in a way. It's there's a conscious link between sexual relations and her father, I think. But it's very subtle.
Yes.
She's almost like a wife surrogate, it seems, right here. I mean, I think it had eluded me that the problem here is that Stanley is not allowed to do what Stanley wants to do, or in this case, what Stanley needs to do. That the adults are, the man is keeping him down.
Man being close to the F-man in this case.
That comes later.
Yes.
Several movies later, but I can't think of Luis's last name.
Guzman.
Guzman.
Yes.
In case it had eluded you, you have Gator and Partridge as family names, and you have Lily and Rose as
poor dogs.
As first names. Lily and Rose being the names of wives.
Yes.
Because dogs listen so well. Right, Ginger?
Poor dogs.
It's probably been, I don't think I've watched Magnolia since the class, which was a year and a half ago. I'm pushing a year and three quarters ago.
No, but it was just February, wasn't it?
No, February.
Oh, you're right.
It seems, at this point, I would have said we were two and a half hours through the movie with what's happening now. the pacing and the spacing of the movie doesn't stick with me. It's one of those nice things about great movies is that they surprise you constantly. And I know that I could watch this movie tomorrow and there'd be things that surprised me and things I didn't notice and different things would grab my attention. There's a lot of public humiliation in the movie. Jimmy is humiliated here. Mm-hmm. Stanley is humiliated here. Frank is humiliated here. All on television. Donnie is humiliated in public, which you were just pointing to on the screen.
Yes. Kind of like radio. I forget.
Are there any other? Jim
is
humiliated. He's sort of humiliated in the sense that when he's talking to Claudia later, he says that he's the laughing stock because he lost his gun.
Right.
Which hasn't happened yet, of course.
No. But I was pointing out earlier that he dropped his baton and it fell all the way down the stairs and he had to go get it.
Ladies and gentlemen, Martin Mull.
A young Martin Mull.
Something that's never it's not a subtle joke, but it's never, you never get beat over the head with it, or Brad's braces, and you get the sense that Donnie's getting...
I don't know, he got that.
Well, you got the big shot of the toothy grin, but you forgot maybe at that point that he was going to get braces. I mean, the discussion about braces is right at the beginning and right at the end. So at this point, almost exactly halfway through the movie, I mean, especially if we assume that most people only watch movies once... I think you've probably forgotten that he's getting braces, and so it's one element of his
you.
One of an element of his what that I forget.
It's just you that forgets.
One element, I think, of his patheticness is, I think, the implication is that he's getting braces
because Brad has braces. I mean, that's a very seventh grade girl thing to do.
Yeah, who'd want braces? They're miserable.
Not me. Did it work?
I had
braces.
I'm
done. It suggests Peanut will have braces, since you had braces and I had braces.
Yes. Peanut will be giant. With these characters, like Jim and Donnie, who are clearly... exaggerations and meant to be you're meant to laugh at them. You are meant to condescend to them, I think. Do you feel that that's misanthropic on the part of Paul Thomas Anderson?
He's not kind to them, but he's not cruel.
I agree with you. But I'm interested because I think, I mean, Donnie is about as pathetic as a human being can be. And pretty much everything he does goes wrong. Mostly because of and it's all his fault. Yeah, his name is Muff. Which is kind of, I mean, he's been tamed. He is the assistant. He's a woman, I think, and that's not very subtle either.
No. Men don't bring men coffee. Women bring men coffee.
Here he's trying to control the interview.
In college, we were talking about satire and reading some Jonathan Swift or talking about Jonathan Swift. And I went to see Uncle Vanya during that time.
I didn't know you had an Uncle Vanya.
In London at the National.
Jagger is your Uncle Vanya?
No, Ian McKellen is my Uncle Vanya.
Okay.
And I was charged with the responsibility by this great professor of explaining why I thought that Chekhov's treatment of people was different. And
different internally within the play, or different from how other people...
Different from Swift in particular, we're talking about. And because there's a mocking in Uncle Vanya that's similar in... But it's not similar in tone, and it's not similar in intent. And what I came up with, and I don't know that it's right, but it felt right to me at the time, and it still kind of does, is that... And this is like that, too, is that it's not satire goading someone to change behavior or pointing out a behavior that ought to be changed, but offering up... These characters in Uncle Vanya are being offered up as the people that they are, and through the course of it are... develop into people who have these flaws but are fundamentally good people, as opposed to people who have these flaws and need to be corrected.
That's something you, I think that clarified something for me. And he is only mocking of people who are of people who really fundamentally don't deserve it.
Yeah.
I mean, when he makes no bones about the people you should hate.
But he doesn't bother to mock them.
He doesn't tickle you about Frank Mackey. I mean, he's an asshole from the start, and I think Jimmy's that way too. So in the way that. The fact that he's treating them lightly, in the sense that there's a comic element to them, tells you that he actually kind of likes them, or puts them in a different frame, one that's a little more frilly and decorated. I think there was some lovely acting from Tom Cruise in that we were talking about other things, but his character's way of diffusing something is to name it. So like when she was trying to be delicate about asking the question, he was essentially naming. He was saying, "Oh, this is the attack part of the interview," or mm-hmm. "Did I hear a question there?" He's
what is your fucking question?
I mean, it's a psychotherapy method, isn't it? I mean, you must name that which is... it can't go unspoken. You have to name it. And so he's naming it and attaching a label to it. I also think there was... And I'm not getting to the point that I wanted to right there, but we're moving on.
Okay.
But also there was some nice acting in his eyes when... And, it's not necessarily that he's a great actor or a good actor, but... on that particular take, it expressed what needed to be expressed, was that there's nothing you could identify, you could look at and say, this is what has changed, but there's something in his eyes that showed that he was defeated at that point. And I think the lawyer is an audience surrogate right here. He's going... I mean, I think there has some element of the audience that has to be at this point in the movie going, what have I gotten myself into? And he's looking at her going, why are you telling me this? Why am I here? Why are you here?
Shut up and take your money.
Ricky Jay is in two roles in this, and it's has got a distinctive enough voice and a distinctive enough face that if you know, if you pay attention to the world of entertainment, you know that the narrator is Ricky Jay, and that the guy who's probably what this private production is.
I have no idea. Some kind of producer, some kind of stage manager.
Look at that look in the lawyer's eyes. He's like trying to act like he's paying attention, but he's like. Is that, I mean, that's just kind of stunt, I mean, it's kind of a stunt, but since the narrator frames it and he's not just an actor, I think. He plays some sort of role, greater role, and I have no idea what we might read into that, but I think it's not an accident, I don't think, and not meaningless. The only way she can unburden herself, and she's had frank conversations with her shrink, a doctor, and now her lawyer.
Pharmacist.
Well, that's a little different.
Yeah, that's true.
But three people who are bound not to, with whom there is a confidentiality. And she's talking about renouncing her inheritance from Earl because feels it's like she wants to admit guilt, but only on her terms in some ways. She's not doing it in a proper way. She's doing it. She said she wants to. Am I saying anything of value, or are you just watching again?
I'm watching again. Sorry. Yeah, I don't know about it being improper. I think it's desperate.
It's not healthy. It's neither healthy nor productive for her or for. I mean, she's.
Right, and at the end of the day, it doesn't accomplish.
Well, it's like half-assed. Like, I'm admitting guilt. I'm being a good person, but I'm only doing it in a context in which nothing can happen. Nobody else can find out about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like, and I suppose anybody who's Catholic who's listening, and devout Catholic, it's like...
Da-da-da-da, confession.
It's like confession. It's private.
I don't think you have to be devout. I don't even know that you have to be Catholic.
Well, I was thinking that they might be offended that I would say that confession's a cop-out.
No.
It's what it comes down to, essentially. The hairstylist did a little too much there by mussing his hair just a little to show his dishevelment, his mental. Just that one little strand.
New World Orchestra could be replaced by Brave Combo. He's on duty, still.
Mm-hmm. We haven't talked about things that we've... one challenge of doing a commentary track for this is that we've had we've spilled a lot of words over this movie and conversation and in my case in writing. And
I'd say we, nothing. Well, we just show up occasionally.
We've talked about this. We've talked about the movie a lot. And we haven't talked about the first thing I wrote about Magnolia, which is if you read the reviews of it, you'll I don't know if the phrase was ever used, but it's
train wreck.
We haven't really talked about it structurally, but my response to that is the movie is not a train wreck. It's about a train wreck, or about lots of little train wrecks. Structurally, it's very sophisticated. It only seems to be out of control, I think. And on the fly, I don't know that we can really talk about kind of this. We've hit at some of the structural things, which is the pacing of the movie, but it's kind of you can't really see the structure, which I think some critics on a first viewing of the movie read to mean that there wasn't one. It's not evenly paced. For instance, in that you're away from characters for long periods of time, and it's not that you're 3 minutes with one character, 3 minutes with another, 3 minutes with another. These are the notes that I said I thought I found. I was actually tracking the length of each scene and kind of how it went from character to character, and I never finished that task, but because some of these snippets are so short, with so many characters, it was more effort than I could afford to at the time. But I think right here is probably the first moment of genuine human connection in the movie, when she's popping her jaw. Do you disagree? Can you think of something earlier? I didn't mean to make it so confrontational. Do you disagree?
I didn't do anything. I just sat here.
Is there anything you can think of that might qualify from earlier?
I would argue.
Phil.
Yes.
Phil, except he's essentially dealing with a vegetable.
I would argue that when Phil gets through to on the search and destroy line,
he hasn't yet.
No, but he's made enough of a case that they're going to talk to him.
Okay, but he's not there yet.
No, he's not, but
that's over the phone with somebody he doesn't know. He's not making a connection. It's a one-way connection at that, one-way something at that point. That's the first, maybe, it's the first moment when the guard is down. On both sides, it seems to me.
That's probably true.
More platitudes. Platitudes are actually a motif. There's the book says, we won't be done with the past, but the past ain't done with us. My name is Donnie Smith, and I have lots of love to give, and Jim Curran's just full of them. It's an interesting contrast, an interesting way of approaching the same spatial relationship that was in Requiem for a Dream, where these split screens to show to essentially create a real hard division between people when there was only a door between them. There he used two shots to show essentially a separation. It's a good line. I was reading about just a little excerpt about something about There Will Be Blood, and the author was lauding There Will Be Blood by diminishing everything else he'd done, Paul Thomas Anderson, and saying that the writing has found the maturity to support his ambition, I think, was something to that effect. And this movie is not written in the language is not artful. But I think it's very well written. Paul Thomas Anderson is no Aaron Sorkin, for instance. You know, he doesn't write these mellifluous, is that the right word?
I have no idea.
Mellifluous, grandiloquent speeches. I'm probably just mangling the language here. Look how stricken he looks there. See, that's when he's quietly judging you, is what he's saying. But that look is not quietly judging. That look is, if I don't move, maybe nobody will know I'm here.
Yes.
Now he's maybe morphed into judging, but at first it was not that way. He's almost quite literally taking his ball and going home.
Yes.
Do you think he wins right there?
No.
No, in the sense that if he stops talking, they can't air the segment.
I don't think that would stop me.
I don't think so either. But the show's called Profiles. It ain't 60 minutes, it ain't. All the communication, to go back to the that moment with the jaw popping, all the communications are structured. They're either scripted or part of a script, or they're transactional. Or business. And that was almost the... And there were conversations between Thurston and Donnie where they weren't that way, but they were, you know, they were pulling their dicks out, basically. It was like the first unstructured contact is what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not... What's the opposite of a mating ritual when two rivals are... You know, the locking of the horns.
Mm-hmm.
That's ritualistic as well. There it's pretty blunt.
And the way he wears his jacket and tie.
Right at the beginning, when you're first introduced to him, when he runs over the parking block, and a guy runs up to him and says, "It's Quiz Kid Tony Smith." I think he almost assumes that everybody knows who he is. Children and Angels. It's one of those things that we talked about, I think, so extensively in the class. That we probably would be ashamed to neglect it because I think we think a lot of interesting things came up. There's only one child. There are two children in the movie. There's Stanley and there's Dixon. I think that. What does the line mean? It's dangerous to confuse children with angels, or however it's phrased, and what does it mean in the context of the movie?
Well, it's a quote, and I can't remember from where.
It's on the Culture Snob Wiki, in fact, so.
Oh, good. I'm glad someone knows.
I can't tell you where it comes from either, but I did at some point look it up and found the source. Jim Curring is making a U-turn. Not insignificant.
What does it mean, and what does it mean in the context of the movie with questions?
Yeah.
Well, I agree with Donnie.
It's not dangerous?
Yes. Poor Stanley. I'm not answering.
So are we meant to look at Stanley and Dixon as angels? Stanley is the obvious reference.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's Stanley, and then there is the potential for what Stanley will become, which is Donnie. I guess make people not introduce complexity into it. Is Stanley an angel? Are we meant to look at him as an angel?
I guess my feeling about it is that if he were treated a little nicer, if his dad were nicer to him, if he were gentler with him and didn't have expectations, didn't hear cash registers when he looked at him, that everyone is better served by that.
So you're almost looking at it in a not a literal sense, but you're taking a fairly straightforward approach about it, which is if he treated him, if he called him his angel, or
yeah,
treated him as, if he treated him, if he put him on the pedestal that one would, you know how people talk about their children as my angel, or
right.
What, if he treated him, if he accorded him that level of love and respect, and all children were treated that way, we wouldn't have all these problems.
No, I wouldn't go that far, but okay. I think we're better served to honor them and create. I think we create better human beings if we treat them well than if we treat them like.
Love the way that shot was done, because they're sitting. We'll come back to that, but there's, you know, it's, the framing suggests it was just because they're sitting in chairs opposite each other, but the real purpose is so that when he stands
stand
up, she can fillet him, basically.
Which does not happen, I'd like to point out.
He's genuinely taken aback when she strikes him.
Yes.
Even though
she fights back.
Even though he deserved it. So, and I tend to discount, and this is not a criticism, I tend to discount the easy reading, the obvious, which is a fault. Because what you've said makes sense, and it fits in with the themes of the movie. And I'm looking for this, and I'm looking for something that's deep and complex and ties everything together, and it might not be that way. It might not be that sophisticated. I mean, movies don't have the sophistication or the depth of novels. Movies are short stories. In this case, it's an extra long short story.
I love them.
There are lots of rhymes. This is...
Look, he's even got wings.
I never noticed that.
Me either, till just now.
He's got one wing. Well, he's a damaged angel. And I don't think that's an accident. I'm sure it's not.
Because if he'd wanted to frame it that way, he'd have done it.
He's essentially doing what Linda did in the pharmacy here. In a public space.
I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yes. I will not suffer the indignities you're trying to... I don't know what the proper conjugation of the verb rot is in this context. Trying to write on me? Or that you want to have rot on me.
That you plan to have rot on me.
So what you don't know from the movie is that... the worm, who was referenced by Dixon, is the guy who came up to him when Dixon was watching the game show, and he's the guy who was walking down the street that Jim took a U-turn. Exodus 25, and who just shot at him. Mm-hmm. That's the guy who killed the guy in the closet. I think the screenplay is fairly explicit about that.
But no, I don't think that comes through at all in the movie.
And that just seems almost like random. Like he goes after some guy and gets shot at. So, Frank has been broken down. Would what happens with Frank for the rest of the movie, would that have happened... Had the interviewer not broken him down? Not defeated him? And then he's getting a second wing. He's healing almost. A little bit of a second wing is popping out of his right ear.
Yeah.
Never noticed that before.
Me either. I think it's...
That is Warren, by the way.
Yeah. I think that it's Janet that's on the phone with him, another woman, telling him what he's gonna do about it.
And who was also... taming another man when she was telling him good boy when he was walking down the hall.
Right.
She's the boss.
Yeah.
Here I think is where Jim Curring's religious faith is I think this is where Anderson is genuinely critical of Jim in the sense that I'm not sure if it's right here or not, but when I believe he asks God why he did this to him, mm-hmm. he questions God for him losing his gun, as if, first of all, it were the end of the world, and second of all, that God gives a shit about a cop in L.A. and his gun. I tell you, God does not care. He told me so.
I was reading something really recently, and I've read it twice now, and I don't know where I read it. That's bugging me, but about a woman who was asking about why her mother didn't ever question why me when something bad happened to her. Mm-hmm. And she said, I never asked God why I got the good things I got, so I certainly don't feel entitled to ask him now. I can't remember where I read that. I've read it twice. Very recently. But... I suppose A to Z pharmacy means.
I think there's a little joke in there that Linda gets, probably has prescriptions covering every letter of the alphabet. Mm-hmm. Most movies have a structure, and going back to the train wreck thing, most movies have a structure of, it's the classic narrative structure of introduction, conflict.
By a woman again.
Introduction, conflict, climax, resolution, denouement. This is like, it cuts out the introduction and the introduction of conflict. I mean, you're in essentially one extended climax in the very beginning. I mean, you've got this level of crisis at the outset, and it only gets worse. I mean, it's, but you never get a, it drops you in right in the middle of shit. It doesn't acclimate you to normalcy. There is no normalcy unless the crisis is the normalcy, which I think with most of these people is true.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly with Linda it's true. Not that I'd ever call her hysterical.
He wouldn't dare.
Harry's being it's like he's being pursued. He's walking down the hallway, look behind
Captain
him.
Captain Muffy or whatever the heck his name is.
Yeah, but he's feeling hunted now. And mm-hmm. I think the metaphor of hunting and is used in his presentation. And that's kind of the level of sophistication in the movie in the conception and the writing of the movie is in those little things. Again, talk about Linda not taking responsibility, not taking responsibility in any way. It's the kid says, and Jim Curran says, the Lord, why is this happening to me? The kid says, it's Stanley's fault because he pissed his pants. It never takes any responsibility for the fact that if he could have answered any of those
any
questions.
Any of those questions, right.
And so shots have been fired, and that's why all these cops are coming, which is why he's going to be
the laughing stock.
The laughing stock, because and here you will find the there's a little bit of connection here where it says Big Earl Partridge Productions, which essentially means that is a connection between two sets of characters that Jimmy's family, the Jimmy Circle, Gator, and then the Partridge Circle ties them together. It's not a meaningful connection, but it's one of those things you kind of have to do because you can't have two unrelated sets of characters, right? And it's held long enough that if you're watching carefully, you're going to notice it.
And you go straight to Earl Partridge.
Who's no longer, clearly no longer Big Earl Partridge.
Yeah.
These are the drops that are going to essentially ensure that he dies very soon, right?
Yes. Can't remember if it's morphine or something else, but
did we talk to in the class? That she apologized, that and this guy made the connection, but she is making an apology to the person she has wronged. She is,
as opposed to
going to her psychologist and saying, I slapped Phil, and I feel terrible about it, and now I'm going to kill myself.
No, I don't.
And then she asks for forgiveness. She's,
and he grants it. He says it's all right.
How could we have missed that?
I don't know.
And because,
and now she's confessing to him. Can you tell him I'm sorry?
Everybody gets moments of redemption, except for Jimmy. Don't they? Earl, the sins of the father, because Jimmy and Earl are the ones, Earl because he doesn't really have a voice or a mind, and barely a body anymore, and Jimmy because he refuses to, if we make the assumption that the accusation is correct,
he never fesses up.
Right. And when he came back on, it was the natural lighting, and he looked very different from the way he looks in the spotlight. And obviously, when you first see him in front of the audience, it's very different. It's you have seen him in a human light before he gets back into performance mode.
And I think the presentation here doesn't have the confidence that the first
doesn't express the confidence of the character.
Yes.
Notice that behind him is the predator, and we're talking about the images behind them.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about him being hunted.
Mm-hmm.
Right there, he's essentially being chased by the predator.
In the beginning, in the first half of the seminar, or whatever it is that we see there, first section of the seminar that we see.
And this is contrasted as the false confession when he, the genuineness of Linda's confession or her apology is contrasted with this, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
This relates, of course, to Jimmy and Claudia. He hit me, that's why I am who I am.
Mm-hmm.
Continue.
But there's a confidence and a security about the presentation in the first segment that we see that is... It doesn't have the anger that this section does. He is... it's not even just because he's swinging things around. It's an uncontrolled, before it's a controlled...
It's performance.
Yes.
Is that whole bit too much? I mean, throwing the table over, not getting the... You're getting the page number wrong. It seems to me that it's a little over the... It's not over the top in the way other things in this movie are, but it's over the... I think it's too much.
Hmm.
A little. I think it could have been toned down without losing anything. You don't need him to flip the table over. You don't need him to get the page wrong, even.
I think the page wrong is a mistake. But the table...
It shows that he's not in control.
Yes. But I think even in that circumstance, I don't believe he'd get the page wrong. The table is the kind of loss of control that I think is right.
I Here he's apologizing essentially to a dead person.
Yes. So, are we done talking at this point? Just going to say, now left, you're watching.
Nothing left to say? Yes, I am.
Junior, what do you have to say? It's quite a grunt.
It's interesting to me that he's, in talking about his dead wife, his reminiscence is almost purely about her physically.
Her hips like a doll, blah, blah, blah.
Like a fucking doll, I think is what he said.
Yeah, probably.
Which is, you know, both as a double meaning. But
yes.
His objective...
But then he says, I didn't want her that way. Now I recognize that I was a dumbass.
But he hasn't changed, though. I mean, he's still describing her in that way. He's still objectifying her. Is it a hopeful movie? I don't think it's... And there are certainly positive things. You have to argue... I don't think you can make an argument that there's not a happy ending. There is a happy ending, in a sense, but... It's a pretty mixed bag still. Something I was thinking when, I don't remember what the moment was, but I was thinking, well, this sort of encapsulates the movie. This is the key moment in the movie. And then ever since I thought that, I've thought that about three or four other times. That there are it's a very simple movie in some ways, and the things that are said at the end, you need to be nicer to me, sometimes people need help, sometimes people need to be forgiven, and I don't think it's not he also says sometimes people need to go to jail.
Yes.
I think you have to also allow for that. I mean, especially since if you consider what Jimmy's crime, the crime that Jimmy's accused of, yes, he should have gone to jail. But you can easily reduce the movie to a couple lines.
Mm-hmm.
But it is no... But that's not the movie. I mean, the movie is... I think any great piece of art is... You lose something if you take something away. If it is truly reducible to something, then it's not very good or not genuine art. I don't think you can take anything out of it. I think everything is essential to this.
You always give me opportunities to say, if I could have said it another way, I would have.
Now, those stories...
What does this poem mean?
The stories at the beginning, I'm troubled by them. I am to the point now where I'm not certain... I don't believe that the suspension of disbelief purpose that they serve is enough to justify their existence. Especially not in a 3-fucking-hour movie. when you're adding 10 minutes on top of something that's that long already. And here's I love what Anderson does with the character who is the most despicable, who has no redeeming quality that we've seen yet, which is Frank. That he is revealed to have at one point in his life sacrificed a great deal for his mother, his dying mother, while he was being an asshole. While he, being Earl.
He, dad being an asshole.
And why, in that, with that revelation, it makes his lie about his parents seem that much stranger, that his father is dead and his mother is retired.
Mm-hmm. Well, would you own up to being... Well, there's a very practical reason that his two wives.
Yeah.
There's a very practical reason he wouldn't claim his father, which is his father, he would never... He's a self-made man. He would never want to be...
The son of anyone.
Right. He would never want to be here because he was the son of Earl Partridge.
Big Earl Partridge.
And him taking care of his mother does not jibe with his hatred of women, or and, you know, his persona. Is it a mistake to show, given? The only nudity in the movie is her through the shower door. The woman who was molested by her father.
Oh, there's...
Her having sex with the other guy with the...
Right, well, her father's having sex with someone her age.
Yeah, but there's no real nudity in that. That's...
No, that's true.
Earl isn't so much in the background, and but the speech... overarches everything. It covers everything because it's you're seeing all the other characters. If we're being literal about it's dangerous to confuse children with angels, Stanley has done something non-angelic by breaking into the library. It's also an honesty about the movie that I love, which is the we all understand what life is short means, but he's right.
Yes.
Life is long. And I think what he means by that is... I mean, it's long enough that no matter at what age we die, we've done things we regret, we've done stupid things. We have too many opportunities to fuck up. You can't get it right. Morphine. So I'm sure people who are opposed to assisted suicide will find the movie morally repugnant for this, or euthanasia in this case, actually, because I don't think Earl has in any meaningful way consented to what is being done to him.
You don't think so?
He's not lucid. He can't. I mean, assisted suicide... And a lot of times the person who is committing suicide has to do the...
Has to push the button, has to whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Has to do the act. Is that the first kiss in the movie? Is that...
No, she kisses him.
It's true. He's the only one who gets kissed, I think, maybe. No, not true, obviously.
Why?
Claudia and Jim.
Yes.
Another beat you over the head. This is a movie. A lot of people are enamored with this sequence. I'm not.
I just really, really, really like the song.
It's one thing I like about it, I really like about it, which is that Earl is singing. After he's been given his morphine, I mean, in the narrative scope of things, it not only breaks you out of the fact that it's a movie, it actually breaks the narrative. I mean, it's like, it's it's the way in musicals, you know, we're stopping the plot, we're going to sing and dance.
You mean like in Buffy?
Yes. The other thing is, like, Philip Baker Hall singing. The character obviously is physically capable of singing, but the character would never sing. And I can't imagine Philip Baker Hall ever singing. Not with that croak. The epitome of living in the past is a giant check for money you don't have anymore.
Never had, because your parents took it.
The camera sets you up for him singing, too, because it's moving in, and as soon as you're past Phil, he has to sing. I think I'm genuinely afraid of every Paul Thomas Anderson movie that comes out. I'm just dreading, because I think he's capable of making truly horrible things. I think it's possible he will never make anything good again. And I'm not saying that because I obviously have not seen There Will Be Blood, but just reading a description of like the first 20 minutes where there isn't any dialogue, I think, you know, when you take those kind of risks...
Or, less charitably, when you're that self-indulgent.
Yes, and I know you hated Punch Drunk Love. I did not hate it.
I did not hate it, but I
did not like it.
No.
But in some ways, I don't like Boogie Nights.
I like it better than you do.
I don't like it at all.
I know.
I'll tell anybody who listens that I don't like Boogie Nights. I didn't like Punch Drunk Love. I like Heartache, but it's problematic. I think it's very possible that Paul Thomas Anderson has made the only movie of his that I will ever love.
But you love it enough that everything...
There, of course, is a lie.
Clearing overnight?
Yes.
Yes.
It's not a lie. It's inaccurate. It speaks to the fact that we cannot predict the future. Sarah Goldfarb. No, wait. It's a different movie. It just reminds me of Requiem for a Dream.
Oh. Yes.
Donnie can't even do a robbery. A burglary, I guess, is what it is. Donnie can't even do a burglary out by his own. He has to borrow somebody's car.
Poor dogs. Listen to those bad dogs, Miss Ginger.
Does the sing-along... detract? I mean, even if you just like the song, is it a problem for you? Does that diminish the movie?
No, but I agree that I don't know that it adds anything.
It's another way of connecting everybody. It's another way of another way of putting everybody in the same box at the same time. Bad Dog Ginger is looking at the television now. She's heard the dogs barking. Thank you. It is interesting that you preface everything that way. You mentioned that right off, unprompted, that Marcia is your favorite character because it was one of the things I was planning to ask you in this.
I think she probably is, which is odd. I don't know that I have a reason beyond.
Do you like Magnolia the movie?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm shocked that...
Because I could see somebody... I could understand somebody who doesn't like the movie saying that. I mean, it's like... It's a backhanded compliment. You know, I love the Marcia character. Yeah, she's in it for...
5 minutes. I know.
So because I'm interested in finding out what Marcy contributes to the whole, or whether your liking of that character is different from...
I think it's independent of...
Of your how you feel about the movie. I mean, there aren't many good people in the movie.
And she's not one of them.
No, but
by
she's...
By any means.
But she's a sharp... As we talked about, she's a sharply drawn character. She is... Bless you, Ginger. She...
Sneezy.
There's a lot of life conveyed in a very short period of time.
Yes, and it's not... Maybe it's because she's...
Rose is very enabling. She says, we do as we do, I guess. And I think you could read that a couple ways, but...
Yeah.
Basically says, well, we can't change what we've done.
She's maybe the only character... unburdened by the drama around her. I mean, she doesn't carry it around on her shoulders. Everybody else is staggering under the weight of this confusion and loss and grief, and she says, that ain't mine!
But she's doing the same thing there. She's denying... She has no plausible deniability.
No.
And she's denying.
No, but...
It's interesting,
but she's not... She doesn't seem... She doesn't strike me as someone who would collapse in an apologetic heap and confess.
Well, the thing that...
which I like about her.
We talked about this, I remember, in the class, was... Jimmy says, I want to apologize. In his emphasis,
he doesn't ever say.
Right, he never says.
I apologize, or I'm sorry.
And it's and you could say that it's not exactly a Freudian slip, but that I'm reading too much into it, you know, because if I say I want to apologize, I'm doing the same as apologizing. But
I don't know. If you said that to me, I would say go right ahead.
He doesn't say I want to apologize. He says I want to apologize. So the emphasis the emphasis is added, but it's meaningful. And I think it speaks to how carefully written the movie is. Because a lesser writer would have had him apologizing right there. And Paul Thomas Anderson has him apparently apologizing.
Or wishing to apologize,
right.
But not
doing it. In a way that a lesser writer is going to say, I want to make... A lesser writer would say, I don't want this to be misunderstood. Whereas Paul Thomas Anderson is inviting it to be misunderstood. Even this is a structured interaction.
Because this is how one behaves on dates, and then she goes and blows it. But
well, there's an opportunity, for instance, when Frank was inside the door with Frank and Phil, an opportunity to have a conversation. Frank was standing there and Phil was staring straight ahead. They didn't say anything to each other. You live in Los Angeles, mister. To go back to something you were talking about earlier, it's the... There's something loving about the mocking that is being done with Jim and with Donnie. This is the guy at your brother's wedding reception.
Yes, absolutely.
Actually, him and Jim are both that guy.
Except I think Donnie is more.
Giving himself encouragement, for instance. And
this is it. This is going to be your big break. This is going to turn it all around for you. Absolutely.
I was wrong when I said Donnie wouldn't confront Thurston Howell, because he confronted his bosses, not in a productive and not in a smart way, and not in a and obviously he's willing to take the most moronic action possible. He's a man of action. I was wrong in saying he wasn't before. A smart burglar. Not using gloves. Now, I suppose his fingerprints are all over everything anyway. So.
Anyway, sure.
Still. Not saying a thing.
And have they been standing there for 15 seconds, or have they been standing there for half an hour? We don't know.
Time is pretty, we make assumptions, I think. But there's that possibility that we're wrong. I mean, every time there's an edit, theoretically, it could mean that no time has passed, or it could mean that years have passed. And you can make logic, you can make reasonable inferences, but his playful spirit is
who's Phil's?
No, Paul Thomas Anderson's. I think one of the things that, even though I didn't like Boogie Nights, I appreciated it, even in that. Does he overact here, Tom Cruise?
No.
Is he acting as a performer?
No.
I'm not. Do you even get what I'm meaning there? Is Tom Cruise
acting, or is...
Is T.J. Mackey performing here?
I don't think so. Because I don't think Phil exists for him as an audience.
But his dad does.
Yeah, but I don't...
I think Tom Cruise is an excellent eye actor.
And maybe Paul Thomas Anderson is the only one who knows how to direct him that way and isn't so busy focusing on his big goofy grin that...
I don't like the way he moves. I don't like the way he talks. I don't find them generally credible. But I believe his eyes in this movie. And maybe it's just this one time that did it, but...
No, because you see the difference in his eyes between the first half of the seminar and the second half. You see the difference in his eyes when he's been beaten down by Guinevere and when he comes back and says, I'm quietly judging you. You see those differences.
Men giving themselves pep talks.
Well, I think the reason I don't think this is acting on T.J. Mackey's part... It's because I think this is the speech he's been working on since he was 15.
So it is a performance. But that's different.
Yes.
But it's different. I agree.
This is the Sawyer reading the letter to his dad. Or to the guy who scammed his mom. I mean, that's that performance rather than to make a Lost reference.
I mean, it's when you fantasize about what you're gonna say to your boss. If they just push you one more inch.
It's that speech rather than...
Yes.
A measured, calculated... Is that the key breaking up?
Yes. Which is... it's just pretty funny, actually. It's not that Donnie couldn't burglarize his former employer. It was that, because if he couldn't get in, you don't get the money, but you're not in trouble, probably.
No. But failed attempt is still attempt.
Well, that's assuming he gets caught. Now he's virtually guaranteed that he's going to get caught. Because he was 95% successful.
Yes.
Which is not dissimilar from winning $100,000 and not getting any benefit from it. So Rose certainly knew this, right?
I can't imagine she didn't.
So why is it only his confession or his... You know, he confesses. Mm-hmm. Why is it only his confession that drives her to leave? And not permanently. I mean, you know, I imagine any... But there's... It's given the authority of permanence because you never see her come back. And you wouldn't ask this question in the context of what has just been said if you weren't leading up to something.
Hi, Flappy.
And Jimmy knows it because he would never... He wouldn't answer the question the way he does if he didn't assume she already knew why Claudia didn't talk to him. Ginger, you have no self-doubt. You are no Claudia Wilson Gator. You're just demanding. What's your favorite moments in the movie? Marcy?
I love Marcy. I do. That ain't mine.
Has he always had that self-awareness?
Jim?
Mm-hmm. And we're at the point where people are saying things that they should have known for a long time, but maybe just figured out. And has he always known he's not a good cop? I think he almost has to.
Oh, yeah.
But he's not a bad cop. He's a by-the-book cop. He's not a good...
What's your favorite moment?
I'm at the point I'm feeling right now.
Mine's the end. Oh, wait.
I'm feeling right now that, that what we were talking about earlier about everything being essential. And I think the whole is dominant in my mind right now. I can't separate, I can't break it down into component parts because everything seems, and I think when I watch it, everything always seems to everything seems so woven together.
She has terrible things in her head that I may have done. Is that an admission?
No. Everything's so woven together, I can't find a thread to pull out.
And I guess that's why Marcy sticks out to me, is because she's...
Because she's a stray thread?
Yeah, I know.
And the moments don't exist outside of the context of the whole.
I think
except
exactly.
For Marcy, except for Marcy, right. Maybe. Which is really strange. Which almost suggests that there has to be a greater importance to Marcy than anybody has figured out.
And I'll look like the visionary when somebody figures it out.
No, Ginger.
So does that mean you can't pull out a character either?
Ginger being confounded by the power cord for the digital recorder. Hi, Snoopy. That line's one of those most quotable things, you know, just that's the line that sticks out for a lot of people.
It means I've met you.
Yes, I find it meaningless. I don't understand it. I don't.
Amy Mann likes it.
I know that she wrote it. I think it's the origin of the entire movie. In fact, I believe that's the line that inspired the movie. I could be completely wrong on that, but I know that the movie is structured around Amy Mann's songs and that they were the genesis, but. I don't understand the line. It's a good line. It's clever. But like a lot of good, clever lines, I think if it's... That's like the first empathy. The first person who's not... Phil's crying because of what the other people are feeling. He already cried on his own when he was doing the morphine drops. But I think that's the first empathy. Somebody thinking of trying to project or understand what other people are going through. Almost there.
Now it's too late. No U-turn. He can't go back and undo it.
Of course, at that exact moment that he is thinking, why can't I go back and undo it? And the reason is because his key broke off.
Right. He tries to make the U-turn, even though it's illegal.
He does make the U-turn.
He tries to make the,
yes,
the global U-turn, not just the physical U-turn.
That street, that cross street is actually something. I think it's like Magnolia or something, street.
Did we ever figure out the title?
No, it's fairly vague. Go, action. Stop, go. In spite of the name of Drunken Commentary Track, I'm going to now have a second beer.
Yeah, you're really slacking.
I know, I gotta be drinking for three. You and Peanut and me.
That's right.
I've gone from homebrew to the Great Lakes Brewing Company Commodore Perry. IPA.
What was that one I smelled last night?
There was, of course, a picture of Claudia as a child. That's probably about the age she would have been molested.
Probably. The painfully hoppy one that I smelled.
I think that was the Hopalicious. The question still stands.
See him? What a mean question. That. Ooh, that smells like pee.
does.
Snoopy.
Pamela's not a fan of the India Pale Ales. In fact, whenever a beer is recommended to Pamela, she'll ask, is it hoppy?
I'm getting better, but I wouldn't drink that. All these U-turns.
Out of nowhere.
You know you can buy those, but you have to buy them in like lots of 1,000.
Yes. Are they still available?
I don't know. That's why I haven't bought
On eBay, she's talking about the plastic frogs that were used in the making of Magnolia.
That's why you don't have any.
Because as much as I would like to buy you a plastic frog, I do not want to buy you 999 more.
If I were to pinpoint a favorite movie in the favorite moment in the movie, it would be the frogs that are bouncing off the diving board, or that moment on Jim's face when the next one hits and he recoils, his shoulders go up, and his mouth opens. Ginger, why do you want to play now? Because you've been sleeping for 2.5 hours?
Give me that.
Is it possible that the entire movie is a cocaine fantasia? Love this shot.
This is a great shot.
The shot of the television where you see Claudia and what's behind her through her and reflected in her television. Here comes the sheet again.
Mm-hmm. She pulls it down. I'd forgotten. I mean, I knew the frogs didn't knock it down, but
hey, no, I'm not playing with you if you pull the ear off.
Bouncing off the diving board right there. I think that the line that...
I like when they hop away after falling from the sky. There aren't very many, but a couple of them actually hop.
I think that where Phil says, why are there frogs falling from the sky?
Does he say why or just there are? Because the coast captain said there are.
I believe he says, why are there frogs falling from the sky? And I believe the screenplay will bear that out.
I'm not questioning that. I just...
It's an important question. I mean, it's obviously one that a lot of people... You know, obviously it's kind of like Psycho. You can't not know...
I like that moment, actually, with all the stuff flying up.
And the ambulance?
In the ambulance, yep.
You can't be surprised by it anymore. But it's also like...
This is the one time I think that the third story in the beginning is connected.
Because it has to fall directly through at that exact moment.
Well... Because the kid who gets shot jumping from the...
True. I hadn't thought of that.
And that this frog falling from the sky saves... Mm-hmm.
Somebody who doesn't deserve to be saved.
Right. As opposed to the kid who gets shot.
I like the way the frogs progress, like the line of frogs. Like it's, you know, how sometimes a storm will happen. You can see the rain coming at you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that hurts me every time.
Donnie falling.
Knocking his teeth out.
The reason I like the question so much is because...
Which question?
why are there frogs falling from the sky? Is because the answer, the question isn't, the question isn't, to use an example from the movie, why did you make me lose my gun, God? It's, how did I put myself in a situation where I lost the gun? And that's not a great example because he didn't lose the gun through any fault of his own. But it's not having the perspective, and there's the, but it did happen in the artwork. That's where you get into, you know, most of these people are in predicaments of their own creation or their own, they have not improved their situation when they had the opportunity. Even obviously somebody who was exploited like Donnie and Stanley here. And there's a very angelic expression on his face right there. It's very nice.
Going back to the stories in the very beginning,
mm-hmm.
are frogs falling from the sky different from the diver in the tree?
No, that's a good, good catch.
Just occurred to me. After all this, it's a surface connection. Yeah. I'm not suggesting.
A really cool thing right here. There are frogs falling from the sky.
And Frank doesn't
notice.
Right. No, I think there's one more connection to be had. I don't know what it is about the Greenberry Hill. And I don't know where that is yet, but...
What is he waiting for here? What does he want? Is he waiting for him to die? Does he want him to say something? Does he want him to apologize? Is he just looking at him?
I think he's waiting to get his father back.
And there would be kind of the hacking.
Rhythmically, I like the way the stories come back. And I like how they re-expand things, and we've been so intimate on these things, and it's bringing out, it's pushing the boundaries of the world out again a little. But again, that doesn't necessarily justify their inclusion, but I like how that operates. If that weren't a movie, I wouldn't believe it.
Warlocks.
He told you not to eat them pills. It's your own fucking fault.
But why does it take so long?
It didn't. It's, remember, this is a, we're actually, it's almost like slow motion, I think. There's another, I'm sorry. Different context. And when you see Frank going to the hospital to see Linda, that's not an obligation. He has no obligation. His dad's dead.
She's not his mother.
Nope. And she's doesn't have. He owes her nothing. And yet he goes to the hospital and sees her. I think that's his genuine redemption right there. When he, you have to go see your dad on his deathbed. I mean. It's expected of you, either
right.
Do it or not. But here, this is charity. He has nothing to gain from this. Well, that's not true, I guess, technically speaking. The whole question of the will was brought up, and
yeah.
He's trying to get on our good side. Forget everything I said.
No, I agree with you, though.
No, so do I. I'm just throwing that in as there's a but.
Yes.
He doesn't know about that conversation.
No.
Does his father heed what he says when he says you need to be nice to me?
No.
It's very inexact. You need to be nicer to me. He has to say it twice. It's not acknowledged. Well, it's actually rebuffed. I envision a buddy comedy with Steve Buscemi and William H. Macy, in which they are simply repeatedly disfigured, abused, and the joke is that it keeps on happening to them. Have there been any two actors more abused?
I don't think so.
Where's the wood chipper? He's the only one. The word love doesn't get used much, and the idea of giving love seems somewhat surprising in this movie, because there's not a lot of giving of anything. Jim really hasn't changed, because you see him, he's just talking here. And it's almost like even he's not listening to himself, because he's the voiceover here. They're both talking. Look, he's putting his love. He knows where to put it now. In the safe. Love equals money.
It's the only thing that matches up.
What?
He's saying something else. But sometimes people need a little help is the only thing.
Is actually saying it at that time?
Yeah.
Not a lovely detail. That you have to get your windshield cleaner to get the frogs off and the blood.
I love how slippery they are.
I love the volume of frogs on this car. Not his car, of course.
No.
The borrowed car.
I wouldn't be rolling the window down, but that's just me.
Talking to himself again. It's profound in being so simple. And for all the sound and fury, for 3 hours, frogs falling from the sky, everything we've seen, all the misery there's been, it asks you basic human questions and states basic human truths that we know to be true, that even if you're not a Christian, charity is good for the world.
But I think
kindness is good for the world.
But it asks that important question, what can we forgive?
No, I'm not...
Do we forgive everything? And
I was not being critical.
I know. I'm just making it a finer point.
It's not unsophisticated. It's more than anything, it's true. I mean, it's true not like it's accurate, but it speaks to the world. I think, it's honest. It speaks to the world. There's also not much smiling, like genuine smiling, and the movie ends on a smile, or at least the beginnings of a smile. I'm trying to think of what smiling there is.
Brad, his braces.
That was a commodified smile. That was, I'm smiling, you know, yes, I understand,
you're right, it's not a genuine smile, but it's...
We didn't talk about the music much or about the Amy Mann songs outside of you liking that one, but a lot of songs...
I like all of them, actually.
A lot of soundtracks are kind of patched together. I think it's nice to... I mean, there are two sets of music here, and there's some other music, but it's John Bryan and Amy Mann songs. I think they work well together, and they also provide some threads that uplink. And what she does here with the way her eyes come up and the smile works in part because it's unexpected. I think
and you certainly haven't seen anything like it on her face.
Right. So if you've suffered with us for this long, which is now more than 3 hours, we're not going to make you suffer through the end credits, so we're just going to stop right now.
Woo-hoo!
Thank you for listening. I need to pee.